Valeria Luiselli was born in Mexico City in 1983 and grew up in South Africa. Her work has been translated into many languages and has appeared in publications, including the New York Times, Granta, and McSweeney's. Her novel, Faces in the Crowd, received the 5 Under 35 Award from the National Book Foundation, and her book of essays, Sidewalks, was heralded by the LA Times as a, quote, wonderful contribution to the long tradition by which authors reimagine their cities. Luiselli currently lives in New York City with her family. Valeria Luiselli, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to speak to you.
Wonderful. And you're calling us from Harlem today.
That's right, from Harlem.
But you're not originally from there, right? You were born in Mexico City?
I was born in Mexico City, right. I didn't live there much. I do consider myself a Chilanga, but as much as I consider myself now a Harlemite, I guess. I've been in Harlem for longer than I ever lived in Mexico City, in fact.
You wrote your novel, your fantastic novel, The Story of My Teeth. You wrote it in Spanish, though, right?
Yes, I did. I write in both languages, but this novel in particular, I originally wrote in installments for workers in a juice factory near Mexico City in the Estado de Mexico, mm-hmm. in Ecatepec. And so it had to be in Spanish originally, right? Because it was an exchange with a group of workers in a factory.
How did a novel come out of an exchange with workers in the factory? That's a fascinating story.
I'm curious about that myself.
For me, it was a fascinating exchange. And unlike anything I'd ever done before, I had done work in collaboration, but not with this intensity and with such an interesting group of readers. So
right.
I didn't know I was writing a novel while I was in that exchange. I started to suspect at some point that I might want to turn what I was writing into a book eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And that, not knowing that I was writing a novel, gave me an incredible freedom as well, which was great. I mean, when you're writing a second novel, it's usually, I had been trying to write a second novel for a while before, in fact, and I was completely, I found myself in a swamp. So it was great to just liberate myself from all the expectations that I placed upon myself and just write and just enjoy the writing process. And it came about initially as a commission from, there's a big art collection called Jumex in Mexico that has contemporary art.
Yeah.
And the Jumex collection, in turn, gets their funding to buy art from the juice factory that the owners also have, also called Jumex.
Right.
So I found it, first of all, kind of bizarre and fascinating that juice ultimately funds very expensive art.
I
wouldn't have ever been able to make something like that up.
No, right.
I was asked by the people in the gallery. They have a gallery, the collection has a gallery, to write a kind of fictional text for a catalog of an exhibition that they were starting to think of and put into place. And so when they asked me to do this, I thought a bit about it, and they wanted me to write in a kind of blog, but I don't really write blogs. So I said, well, let me think of a way of doing this in installments, which is what they wanted, but not into a blog feed.
Right.
And I did some research. I thought about things. I made notes. And then I came up with the idea of writing not really directly for them in the gallery, but for the workers in the juice factory, whose work ultimately funds the gallery.
Right.
And initially they were a little bit suspicious of the idea.
But I
managed to convince them somehow. And it turned out fantastic because, I mean, the person that I was working with there in the gallery helped me put it together because I wasn't physically in the factory.
Right.
I was here in the U.S. And I would just basically send an installment a week, and that would get printed in a kind of little chapbook that was distributed in the factory. And a group of about 12 workers were interested in the project, and they formed a reading group that met once a week.
Oh, that's great.
They read out loud.
That's great.
It was fantastic. They read out loud, and then after their reading, they would comment and criticize what I... They basically workshop what I sent them.
That's great. That's great.
It was. And then, yeah, and then they would just end up just telling their own stories and talking about their lives. And that was sent to me in an audio file every week, and I would listen.
Oh, wow.
And then in return, write another installment. Wow. So it was really like a conversation. I didn't know what I was going to write before I heard their own sort of audio installment. Yeah, it was a great process. Impossible to repeat.
Just the fact that I was really intrigued right in the beginning from the fact that it was from Humex factory workers, because that's one of my favorite juices. But, and I wondered, you know, did you get like a lifetime supply of free Humex?
No.
No.
No,
but,
not at all.
Yeah, no, I was just mostly intrigued, though, by I wanted to know more about what you just explained right now, how that sort of collaboration happened between, did you actually get to collaborate with the workers themselves and sort of, you know, work with their stories? And it sounds like you really did. And just what a unique experience for any writer, right?
Yeah, it was unique. I mean, I had done collaborations before, as I said, and I like collaborating because it kind of pushes you outside your comfort zone and forces you to think in terms that are not necessarily literary, but outside the space where a writer usually works in his mind or her mind.
Right.
But this was completely unique in that the kind of collaboration was pushing both the workers and myself to think of ways to connect their work, my work, and what was going on in a gallery near them.
Right.
It was like a three-way thing also, because we had at the end, the idea was never to stray completely from what was going on in the gallery. The idea was to also think about what art spaces do and what kind of thing happens to objects when they are displaced out of a gallery or placed into a gallery, and how value is created in art objects. So it forced all of us, I guess, to think out of our boxes and into an area where we were all kind of tourists.
Right. That's a good way of putting that, yeah.
It's interesting that you say that you didn't know you were writing a novel until later, because actually the experience of reading this novel, I sometimes forgot I was reading a novel.
Mm-hmm.
The story does come together, but I guess that answers one of the questions that I had about the way you break up the story into parts. Actually, book one is the story, and then after that it seems to be almost like a primer for the art of auctioneering. At one point, did you realize you were writing a novel?
That's a good question. I probably realized toward the end that it was going to be a novel. But when I say that I realized I was writing a novel, it doesn't mean that I didn't know that I was writing fiction.
Sure. Right,
absolutely. I was building characters and imagining situations, and I was doing a lot of things that novel writing entails. But I wasn't in my mind until quite toward the very end of the process thinking of a book. Final product book, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think the mechanism also forced me to think of very early novels, so like late 19th century, very early 20th century novels, and how many of them were written in installments for cheap newsstand publications, and therefore had to be episodic and had to kind of create a character very quickly and then put him in a situation and then create enough material for there to be a next installment. I mean, my procedure was very similar to, I guess, procedures that very early novelists would use. It's also not very, I mean, in terms of thinking episodically and of the type of characters that appear in The Story of My Teeth, it's, I mean, the model is for me the first modern novel, which is The Quixote, which also has a kind of tragicomic narrator who is always finding himself in different situations and has to kind of get out of them.
Yeah, right. And of course, for our listeners, the book we're speaking about is The Story of My Teeth by author Valeria Luiselli. You know, the book is, I mean, it's so rich with characters, scenarios, dialogue, concepts, and, you know, as I was preparing for the interview, I was overwhelmed. I found myself unsure where to begin. I thought, where do you begin with an interview like this? And obviously, it'd probably be the Humex Factory, the collaboration there. But, you know, for you yourself, I mean, because the book, again, is so rich, how do you find yourself explaining the book to folks? Or, you know, I guess for our listeners out there, how would you describe the book?
And it's always really difficult to explain your own book. And one of the things that's different about this book with respect to my other books is that that I had it kind of explained to me as I was writing it.
Mm.
So because the workers were reading it each week and interpreting it, their interpretations of the book were sources of meaning for me, right?
Right.
And they helped me understand what I was doing early on and take it always a step further for them, right?
Right.
What is this book about? I mean, it's a book essentially about, I mean, in one very, very simple level, about an factory guard who has really bad teeth and who wants to replace them.
Right.
And one day finds out that there was a writer somewhere who managed to write a novel and get enough money from it to replace his teeth. And he says, well, I mean, if someone can write a novel and replace his teeth, I can do something similar.
Right.
And so he's not a writer, so he said, well, like, novelists are a little bit like auctioneers, I guess. And
yeah, they're selling something.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean,
that's right,
in a way, the book is a meditation about the art of selling stories.
Absolutely,
in a cynical way. I mean, there's a very cynical side to it, right?
That's right.
The entire sort of commercial apparatus that goes into producing a narrative around a novel that then sells a novel.
Right, right, yeah.
Which makes writers very much like salesmen.
Right, right.
Themselves and of their stories. So he kind of gets that, and he decides, well, I'm not going to be a writer. I'm going to be an auctioneer. And he auctions anything that comes his way, including at some point his own teeth, which he finally manages to get plucked out and replaced by the supposed denture of Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
And
yes.
And then auctions his teeth as if they were the teeth of famous people.
Right.
Like yes. Virginia Woolf.
Plato.
I think one of them belongs to Plato.
Yeah. Borges.
Borges.
Yeah. Let me interject and ask you a question right there, because this is kind of a fun question, but it was something that struck me curiously. You know, the main character, Gustavo, who everybody calls Highway, you know, obviously his teeth belong to people like that, you know, Marilyn Monroe and Virginia Woolf and all that. And I'm wondering, in my mind, I kept thinking, gosh, did she create a list of people, and how does she select which people those teeth belong to? Was there any one particular person that you actually left out and wished you had, attributed one of the teeth to?
Did I leave anyone out?
You know, how did you select?
Quite a lot.
Right.
I left Bolaño out. He has great dental stories.
That's great.
That's right.
Yeah, they're dental stories.
He has great dental stories. Martin Amis, I left out as well.
Right. Wonderful.
For fear of I don't know. I mean, if you talk about contemporary life people, it's always you're getting into difficult territory. So I was respectful of
because they're still using their teeth.
Yeah, they're still using their
teeth. Yeah, people's teeth. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a sensitive issue sometimes.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And, you know, that was.
So I have to ask you, the main character, his mom had a velvet green armchair that she got from Mr. Cortázar. Are you winking to continuity of Parks there?
Yes, you got it. not everyone gets that one. It's absolutely the continuity of Parks by Cortázar.
Yeah, and it kind
I'm
of...
I'm really glad you read that into it. Yeah, I mean, the book is full of little references like that, like in this case to Julio Cortázar, one of my favorite writers, who has a story, the continuity of Parks, that where the narrator is sitting on a velvet green armchair, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, what I feel there is that readers don't have to get every reference at all in a book, but I was really interested in seeing how references to names and to things like the one you caught on to there kind of create a weight or a gravitational pull around the narrative in which they are embedded.
Right.
So, like, if you put Julio Cortázar in the narrative tissue, and someone knows who Cortázar is, and then gets a reference to, in this case, the armchair, that's going to create like a kind of indent in the narrative around it, in the narrative tissue around it. And when someone doesn't know, it's just going to be a
name
just
detail,
within
absolutely.
A story, right?
Yeah.
Right.
It also deepens it in the sense that it's almost a wink to the reader saying, you know, that this main character that's telling this story is just a main character in a story.
As well, exactly, as well. And I mean, one of the fundamental things that I was thinking of when I was doing that, this sort of placing names or dropping names into the narrative was trying to think about how names can be seen as objects that can be displaced and moved from any given context to another and then change in their meaning and in their value. So like it's kind of like what is often done in contemporary art procedures with objects. They're displaced from one context into another, and then their meaning changes completely. So, it, I mean, in a way, it all comes back to Marcel Duchamp, right, and how when he moved the fountain, this object that belongs in a bathroom, into the gallery space, it was suddenly endowed with a new meaning and value. What I do is kind of the opposite thing. It's sort of taking names outside the literary pantheon and seeing what happens to their value and meaning outside. So there are references to writers like Cortázar, who are just, Cortázar is not a writer in the story, just a next door neighbor.
Right.
What happens to that object name when it's displaced?
Right. Yeah. And one of the other literary references that was actually my favorite was the one to Marcelo Sánchez Proust, who writes in his diary, and then you show us his sort of diary entry, which is like this paragraph with only two periods. So, you know, which is obviously a nod to the French novelist Marcel Proust. You know, and that's one of the questions I actually wanted to ask you is then, as you're writing the book and composing it with that intention, do you find yourself having a very clear vision of who your intended audience is for the book, or do you just sort of disregard, throw that out and just write to your own whim or to your own, you know, desires or to your own?
No. There isn't a view of an audience in that. I think precisely my idea there was that names are so relative in terms of how we perceive them and what value and meaning we endow them with.
Right.
So Marcel Sánchez Proust can be just a strange name of someone's uncle.
Absolutely.
Or can be, for in another linguistic community, can have all the attached values and references that a name like that one has.
Right.
The idea was to sort of circulate those names in different linguistic communities, from factory workers to, I don't know, my uncle in Mexico City to, I don't know, a studious professor in Amsterdam, whatever.
Right.
You mentioned Bolaño, and the book mentions Borges and Cortázar. And you know, you have grown up, I'm sure, and have spent a lot of time reading novels from Latin America and novels written in Spanish, but you also are clearly just as equally able to read in English and to speak in English and to write in English. And so I'm imagining you've read a lot of North American novels too. And I'm always interested in, I think the assumption from North Americans is that Latin American novels are magical realist, and you know, North American novels differ in that sense. But of course, it's much more complex. And I think the Latin American novels tend to be more referential when it comes to literature and more intellectual. And I'm just wondering if you would identify with Latin American novelistic attributes over North American, or do you even see a difference?
Well, first of all, magic realism, people tend to forget that it started with an American novelist, really, right? With William Faulkner. Mm. And although the term was not used as such, it was really, it was through William Faulkner that writers like Juan Rulfo and later on García Márquez started developing a kind of view of how literature should represent the world in order to convey both a political message in terms of the absurdity of the world and the way that the non-explicable interacts with everyday life. But people tend to forget that when they think of magic realism, right?
That's
also an American genre. And then in Latin America, as in, I would say, in the Spanish language, there have always been sort of two different branches of a great tree. And one of them, which I would say began precisely with Don Quixote, is one that is, yes, more self-referential, more meta-literary. I would not necessarily say more intellectual, but perhaps more self-conscious in a good way, more conscious of literary tradition and how writing is always a conversation with that tradition. And there's another branch that has always been just a more realistic, what is called here in America as sort of the realist novel.
Mm-hmm.
And those writers exist just as, I mean, there, perhaps there are more writers in the realist tradition than in this other one, both in Spain and Latin America.
Right.
I think of Carlos Fuentes, he's a great realist novelist, right? Or in Spain, Javier Cercas or Javier Marías. And then there's this other tradition where I would put people like Enrique Vilamatas or Cesar Aira or Bolaño, where yeah, in fact, there's a different kind of procedure and interest and dialogue. And I don't know, I wouldn't place myself in any in particular. Perhaps my bringing up as a reader, my education as a reader, has fed more on the works of people like Vilamatas or Cortázar or Bolaño or Clarice Lispector than on the others.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that I don't ever want to try something different. On the contrary, I mean, I never want to stay in one single place. I want to always have the freedom to go wherever I want to. That's why I'm a writer.
That's interesting, actually. And that's interesting because I know that in your personal life, you know, you traveled quite a bit growing up as a child, from what I read. I believe your father was an ambassador. And I was wondering, too, how does that experience of traveling from place to place, you know, factor into your writing? But it sounds like you're kind of echoed that right now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's factored in many ways. And in one particularly significant way, I guess, is that I don't see myself as belonging to any one particular tradition. And as you were saying earlier, I mean, I don't know, I grew up on reading the American modernist poets as much as I did by reading the Latin American novelists. So in that sense, yeah, I've always felt kind of free to jump around and reinvent my own identity.
I'd like to ask a little bit about the translation process for this novel specifically. Did you work closely with the translator and, you know, constantly give her feedback? Her name is Christina McSweeney.
Yeah, well, Christina is a genius. That's first of all,
actually. That's it. So
I'm sure she thinks the same about you.
She's really something. She's really something. She's like a force of nature. And she, ever since she started translating my work, we've had a very deep connection and a very interesting and just fun way of working together, where we sort of ping-pong a text back and forth 1,000 times. And I give her a lot of freedom in terms of how she translates my books. And in turn, I get a lot of freedom to rewrite. So which is great and necessary. I mean, I have a voice both in English and Spanish, so it's important for me to be able to see her translation as a kind of first draft of the English life of something that has a life in English for me as well, right? So I rewrite a lot after she creates her first draft, and we ping pong back and forth. With this particular novel, it was kind of interesting that she was more involved than ever from the beginning of the project, because it's not like I finished a manuscript and then send it to her, but I sent her, for example, the installments and also the recordings of the workers reading.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, wow.
She would hear them, and she also worked with their voices when she was translating into English. When she finished a draft and we decided that it was going to be a book, etc., she came to New York, and we read the entire manuscript aloud several times.
Oh, wow.
Working around the voice and just heavily workshopping it until there was a version that I was happy with.
Nice. Well, it's a fantastic book, and we understand, too, that it was nominated recently for the National Book Critics Circle Award, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank
the
you
book,
very much.
Absolutely. The book is The Story of My Teeth by author Valeria Luiselli, out with Coffee House Press. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
It's been a great pleasure speaking to you, too. Thank you.